glad to have you all with us for Political Rewind. You just heard an update on what's happening down along the Georgia coast from Ellen Reinhart. We're going to talk a little bit about that at the very beginning of the show today and then move on to a pretty big political agenda that we have to take on. Greg Bluestein is here. It's Wednesday. He joins us on Wednesdays. He is political reporter, lead political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's in the paper every day, and he also files regularly for the Political Insider blog. You've just come from a briefing with Governor Kemp on the latest on the storm and what's going to happen in the day ahead, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's saying even though the storm seems to be veering further from Georgia's coast, to be cautious, to be vigilant, and for the folks who have evacuated, do not return yet.
We'll talk about that in just a minute. Stacey Evans is with us. She, of course, is a former member of the Georgia House, Democrat, ran for governor in the primary last cycle out. Thanks for being with us, Stacey.
Thanks for having me.
Leo Smith is sitting right next to you. He's a longtime Republican operative in Georgia, used to be the head of minority outreach or minority engagement is, I think, the way you always like to say that. And now is doing some consulting. Do you have candidates in this cycle yet, Leo?
No candidate. I'm working on some back office things for infrastructure.
Oh, yeah. All right. That sounds good. Dr. Andre Gillespie, Emory University political science professor, just back from the annual conference of political science professors and associate professors from all over the country. I know you do that every year.
Yeah, so the American Political Science Association.
Well, I'm glad you could be back with us today. Let's turn right away to news about the storm. Do that for just a couple minutes, Greg. Let's listen to a little bit of what the governor said when you were with him. Here's his latest update on what's happening down along the coast.
The National Weather Service latest projections show that Hurricane Dorian nudged slightly west with significant rain bands and strong winds moving into our coastal counties. We're seeing that right now. Bryan, Camden, Chatham, Glenn, Liberty, and McIntosh counties remained under a tropical storm warning as well as a storm surge warning. Brantley and East Charlton County as well as Wayne County are now under tropical storm warnings based on the new projections that we have this morning. We are getting reports of downed trees already in Glenn and Wayne County, which obviously that can be dangerous if you're still in your home with a tree falling on your home, knocking down power lines. So we urge citizens to be on the lookout or be cognizant of that. Serious concerns remain that we will see damaging and life-threatening surf with a coastal surge of 3 to 5 feet. We expect a high tide between now and 3 p.m., which could significantly worsen flooding. We expect another high tide shortly after midnight, where again we can see a strengthened storm surge and more flooding, depending on where the storm is at that point.
So that's Governor Kemp less than an hour ago updating things. Greg, you were there. Congressman Buddy Carter is on the phone with us right now. He's down in Pooler, and if you're not just exactly familiar with where Pooler is, you're basically right east, west, rather, of the Savannah airport, right, Congressman? So you're right, you're basically in Savannah, right?
Oh, yeah. It's all technically Savannah. In fact, there's parts of Savannah that are west of us here in Pooler as well.
Okay. Give us an up. Tell us briefly how things are going down in Savannah. I know that you're not expecting the hurricane winds or perhaps even tropical storm winds on land, but the storm surge is still a big concern for folks down your way, isn't it?
Well, it is a big concern. Of course, storm surge is a big concern, as you say. We are also concerned about the rain bands that are coming through, which, we're having a new moon now, so we've got high tides as it is. That in combination with the storm surge, with the rain bands, and then, of course, wind is always a concern.
Congressman, state officials just reopened I-16 eastbound to head back into the Savannah area. What's your message to evacuated residents who might want to return earlier?
Well, the window of opportunity for people who are going to leave is just about expired. So we would encourage them just to make sure you secure yourselves as best you can, and please be safe. As far as people trying to get back in, now is not the time. Please stay away until You get more information from emergency management officials. They will let you know when it's safe to come back. But just because the contraway has ended at noon, doesn't mean that we want people coming back. It simply means that there's enough room on the other side on the westbound lanes for people to get out if they still want to get out. But I do say that window of opportunity is shrinking quickly.
Leo Smith wants to ask you a question, Congressman.
Hello, Congressman. Hey, I noticed that you've got a lot of media, national media, camped out on the riverfront down in Savannah. And I was just wondering, with all the attention we've been giving to our ports down there, I mean, is there potential impact, on our infrastructure that we've been working on?
Well, there is. Fortunately, the Georgia ports are very well prepared. And so is all the emergency management officials here up and down the coast, from Camden County all the way up to Chatham County. This isn't our first rodeo, unfortunately. We've been through this before, and we know what to do. And, yes, we are preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. The only predictability about hurricanes is they are unpredictable. That's the only thing you can really say about them. If this hurricane were to wobble 20 miles westward, it could be devastating. And for those who are thinking, oh, it has decreased in its strength from a Category 5 to a Category 2, listen, a Category 2 hurricane is a dangerous hurricane, and we need to be aware of that.
Tom Faust just corrected me. I was under the impression that you were not expecting hurricane-force winds on land. He says that is still possible. And essentially what you're saying, if there's any kind of wobble, that could happen.
Absolutely. And you know, that, of course, has been our experience in the past with hurricanes. We've seen them wobble and go west or east, whatever it may be. Obviously, we're hoping it will go further east, but at the same time, we have to be prepared. And I am concerned. I'm concerned that some people are complacent and that they simply think that a lot of this is overkill. Well, that's the responsibility of emergency management officials. They have to make sure that they're doing everything within their power to make sure that our citizens are safe.
And the governor kind of echoed that point. He said he talked about his better safe than sorry approach and said state officials learned after the ice storm in 2014 to take every step possible, and better to be accused of over-preparing than under-preparing, right, Carson?
Yeah, although I do have to say, we had listeners on our show yesterday when we talked about the mandatory evacuations who sent us notes that they were angry mm-hmm. that they were being forced to mm-hmm. evacuate. And I think that sort of makes a point that we talked about on the show yesterday, which is you just can't win a lot of times in these situations. Congressman, paint us a quick picture, if you will, of what it looks like in Savannah today in terms of people who have left, boarded up stores. Just give us a quick description of what it's like down there right now.
Well, there are very few businesses that are still open. Most of the businesses are closed. It does not appear that as many people have left this time as did during Matthew or some of the previous storms. That is of concern to myself and to the emergency management officials. And to those people who have stayed, we would just plead with them, please be careful. Please don't get out. Please stay hunkered down and let's get this through. Hopefully it'll pass by quickly. Hopefully it'll have the least amount of impact that it can on us.
All right. Congressman Carter, we thank you for taking a little time to talk with us. We hope everything goes very well for you, for all of our listeners down there along the coast, where we've got you all in our thoughts. And, of course, GPB News will be updating everybody regularly on what's happening with Hurricane Dorian in the hours ahead. Thanks a lot, Congressman.
Thank you.
All right. Greg, let's move on to this story that ended up on the front page of your newspaper today. And let me set the stage just briefly, if I can, and then open it up for conversation. So a matter of weeks ago, Governor Kemp announced that he wanted what I think it's fair to characterize as pretty dramatic cuts in state budgets, agency budgets, across the board. In the first stage of this, which means the supplemental budget, mm-hmm. he demanded 4% cuts. Then he wants for the next fiscal year budget, which starts July 1st, 6% more in cuts, right? Okay, so relatively soon after that, Speaker Ralston announced that he was taking the governor very seriously. He wanted to make sure that the legislature could get on top of this with agencies. And he announced he was going to have budget hearings probably starting at the end of September, early October, right?
Mm-hmm.
The latest development now is that Governor Kemp has told the agency heads, ignore the requests for a budget for budget hearings, which the speaker's people have already said we're going to do the last week of September, and just submit your budgets to us. What the heck is going on here, Greg Bluestein?
Well, there's some tension clearly between the Georgia House and Governor Kemp's office. And there's a usual pattern to these things. You have usually near the beginning of every legislative session, Governor Kemp unveils his budget proposal. Then the House and the Senate, but first the House usually gets the first crack, almost always gets the first crack at it, and the last crack at it, and then it goes to, and then it's passed by both chambers. It's the one thing that Georgia legislature has to do is pass the budget, and Kemp gets the final sign off on it. Well, in this case, the state House is trying to exert a little bit more influence over the shape of this budget by holding these hearings. They feel like they were caught off guard. They were stunned by this.
By the announcement for the 10% cuts over a period of months.
10% cuts because just a few months ago we were in session and there was no hints of this coming. We all knew that there could be budget cuts down the road, but there's no hint of budget cuts this year. And so they feel a little scorned. They feel a little burned by this. And Governor Kemp's administration essentially says, you can have a crack at it. Just wait till during the legislative session. They want the first crack at it. They want to be able to shape the budget their way rather than having outside influence.
Yeah, Stacey, you obviously were part of this process during your years in the legislature. I mean, the governor's agencies do submit their budget proposals to the governor before legislative hearings take place, typically. So that's not unusual, right?
Right. That's not unusual. What was unusual would be considered unusual here is the legislature saying, hey, we're going to have these hearings and copy us on everything that you send to Governor Kemp. So I wouldn't fault Governor Kemp for saying what he said, but it does certainly reveal a little bit of tension and as has been hinted to, perhaps shows that the legislative leadership at least is not convinced that these cuts are necessary. And if you give a little context to the leadership's position, Terry England came in as chairman of the Appropriations Committee when the economy was going down fast, when Governor Deal first came in, and they had to make big cuts. And he's lived through that. And I would imagine from his perspective, he's thinking, if we don't have to cut, I'm not going to ask these agency heads to do it. I'm not going to ask my staff to go through the laborious process that it takes to implement those cuts. And I think that may be what the legislature was thinking when they set these hearings. But I guess now it's not going to happen.
I always have to do a disclaimer here. GPB is a state agency, and so our head is going to have to, our CEO is going to be part of this process. But I also always point out that programming, this show, the other shows on our air here, are not funded by state money. We are on the air because of your donations out there. And I just want to make that clarification. But Andra, I think in the age of Donald Trump, talking about, you know, report to me, don't worry about, you know, whatever, whoever it is, there is something that feels like a kind of a new attempt to exert a power that perhaps a governor before this might not have wanted to do in such a dramatic fashion.
I agree. And it's actually pretty unfortunate that this would happen. So I think a lot of people will hear this and not being familiar with the budget process will be like, well, doesn't spending start in the legislature, particularly in the House, and wonder why they're not taking the lead or being allowed to take the lead. And then there's this issue of oversight. And so the legislative function is to provide oversight to the executive branch. And so that's where this actually starts to look really defensive on Governor Kemp. Part. I think if we could put all of that aside, just from a practical standpoint, it's better for the executive and the legislative branch to be partners in this process because there's going to have to be a lot of translational work done. And what seems to have not happened here is there hasn't been a conversation about why these cuts are needed at this particular time. It seems like the bond market is looking very favorably to these changes. It looks like Governor Kemp is actually being proactive in foreseeing that the economy might not be as strong as it will be in a few years. And so this would be helpful, but it would actually be really helpful if people were working together on this so that it could be explained why it might be prudent to do budget cuts now when there doesn't appear to be a need for
it. Thank you for pointing that out. The bond rating services have praised Governor Kemp for being willing to act before he finds the state in any kind of hole if there's an economic slowdown, Leo.
I think exactly that. I think Wall Street is starting to look for someone who is showing some foresight and vision on what's expected with our markets. And, you know, the other thing I think is a very good look, Dr. Gillespie, for the governor to actually be demonstrating a sentiment, and that is that we don't necessarily trust the political process to shrink government spending. And so sometimes executive action needs to be put up a little bit higher on the pedestal. And this is a great discussion and a great opportunity for the public to see how that budgeting process works and what responsibilities administrators have over the legislators.
Yeah, but what I would argue is he's foregoing that opportunity by telling people to not go to the hearings because that looks defensive. That looks antagonistic.
Or it looks Trumpish.
Yes. And so if you're doing this, one, for sound reasons and to be transparent, you might as well just go along with them and do the hearings.
Yeah. You know, Stacey, so here, let me paint a scenario and see if you think I'm right about this. If the budget hearings were to move forward, if Terry England could go ahead and have these late September budget hearings, and any given agency head comes in, says, here's where I'm planning to cut, it at least opens a door for the Appropriations Committee to give feedback that says, well, we're a little concerned about this cut or that cut because it may diminish the services you're at, whatever the conversation might be. Mm-hmm. There is that potential to happen in a hearing. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. I mean, that could happen in a hearing. I would argue, though, that the same agency head, when he goes to talk to Governor Kemp, whether that's to the governor directly or through his staff, that same conversation can be had. But the difference is it's not held in public and you might not have the opportunity.
Well, it's also not being held by the House, which has a certain amount of control over the budgeting process.
Sure. I mean, I think eventually those hearings will happen, whether they happen in September or whether they wait and happen in January. So they will happen. What I find a little bit frustrating about this whole conversation that started a week ago is that let's assume that it is prudent to prepare for a downturn in the economy. Why don't we also talk about other ways that Georgia might be able to raise revenue? What other job creation opportunities are out there? I mean, we're sitting on this legislation that just passed that opens up cultivation of medical cannabis. But yet the agency that's supposed to approve the licensees for these companies to start the cultivation has done very little. That application process hasn't started. That process is going nowhere right now. That is a lot of potential money in tax revenue on the table that we're not even working on getting out of the gate. So there's two ways to deal with an economic downturn. And unfortunately, it seems like Kemp is focused only on one side. And if you look at some of these departments that are going to have to be doing cuts, you're talking about public safety, public defenders, Georgia State Patrol, GBI. You're talking about the Department of Ag, which may have some big expenses coming up soon if this hurricane is bad. That doesn't necessarily seem like a good idea to me.
All but 23% of the budget is vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And Speaker Ralston, to Stacey's point, actually assigned this committee to look for ways to raise revenue, too. And he packed the committee with a lot of people who are supportive of different gambling initiatives as well. So that's an interesting side note on this. But politically speaking, for Governor Kemp, as a candidate, he pledged to cap state spending based on a formula. He hasn't quite gone there yet. His campaign, his aides say that he will at some point. But also politically speaking, he also wants to safeguard his other big campaign promise, which is the 5% teacher pay raise. Right. He's already gotten about halfway there. He's got the 3%, but the other 2% is going to be very costly. So this is a way he feels by ordering these budget cuts, but also safeguarding that teacher pay raise, he can fulfill that.
So Andre made, I think an interesting point, a very valid point, which is he could have had a partnership with legislators over the budget cuts, although presumably, as Stacey has suggested, maybe everybody's not on board with how much of a cut the governor's looking for, and that's a cause for some of this friction. But in a larger universe in terms of all this, Greg, this is a perhaps a bad way to start the next session underway and could presage some pretty rocky times between the governor and at least the House in the months ahead.
and rocky times in general. The Georgia legislature hasn't had to deal with budget cuts in 6, 7, 8 years. You know, not since the beginning of Governor Deal's terms, when you had to have really difficult decisions, not just about Hope Scholarship, but other budget cuts. And at a speech the other day, Kemp said, "Hey, look, we're not going to have the good times that Governor Deal enjoyed for most of his first term and in all of his second term. We're going to have to make tough decisions." But you're right, state lawmakers aren't quite on board with the fact that they have to make tough decisions now. They feel like some of those decisions might have to wait, should wait until there's a recession or there's more difficult financial times.
Okay, you know what? While we're talking about potential cuts to funding in the state of Georgia, I'm going to skip down the line a little bit. We learned overnight that President Trump has and the Department of Defense have agreed that they're going to take $3.6 billion from previously approved projects across the country to divert to spending on the wall. And although we have no idea, Greg, how Georgia, we're told that all 50 states could be involved in losing military funds. And although we don't know what's specifically going to happen here, Greg, the Pentagon had previously identified $260 million in Georgia that could be on the chopping block under Trump's emergency spending for a border wall. He declared that back in February. And that could include as much as $100 million for cyber instructional, a facility at Fort Gordon, nearly $31 million for a hangar at Moody Air Force Base. Leo, right now, the president needs to get his wall under construction. But in the long run, when states see the possible cuts that they're going to take for facilities that are income producing, it has a potential to backfire on them, doesn't it?
It's certainly going to be a very difficult discussion. And I think already part of this is fact-finding, because we've learned that the president has focused on repairing wall space that had been in disrepair. And so while some has argued that he hasn't done anything on the border wall, the fact is that he's done quite a bit of repairing and reconstruction. And then so this will make the next argument. OK, you've got to follow through with this campaign promise. Republicans still want the wall. They do. And so meet your constituents' requests.
All right. Well, this came up at the last minute, and I'm going to get into this more on Friday's show. But I just wanted to get a quick read from you all about the fact that Georgia could lose, especially Stacey, in cybersecurity area. Right now, Augusta, with its cybersecurity facility, the state is trying to brand itself as a center for cybersecurity.
Not only is it a big deal for job creation and economic development in Georgia, this is actually something that is needed. This is something that would be more closely categorized as an emergency as opposed to this fake border wall emergency that Trump wants to pretend exists. What I don't understand about this, as with so many other things with President Trump, is why his base of supporters would believe him if he stood up and said that he's halfway through construction on the wall, whether he was or wasn't. And so it doesn't matter for his political message. And in the meantime, he risks alienating and making angry voters who were expecting jobs to come. Talk about really messing up your potential voting base when you talk about cutting from the military.
That makes
no sense.
Andrew, that's an interesting point. Promises made. Democrats could go out and campaign next year on promises made, promises not kept, like the wall. But Stacey Evans makes a point. Trump's voters, if he tells them he's building the wall, the chances are good they're going to go along with him.
Well, I mean, and while that's definitely true, I think the thing that he doesn't want to have to deal with is the cacophony of reporters saying that this isn't true, or even though it would be like, you know, the 12,000 on the first lie, the, you know, one more sort of lie on the PolitiFact meter and all those other types of things. So, yes, he has to expend time and energy calling things fake news if he gets called out for making certain things up. You know, I think the question that I have from these projects that will now be suspended as a result of them is, how aware the communities that are directly affected by this, and even those that aren't, were aware that these projects were in the offing. To the extent that they weren't aware of them, I'm not sure that suspending or postponing those projects, or, you know, deferring them because you're using the money for other reasons is actually going to make that much of a difference. Now, on the other hand, I think the optics of, broadly speaking, diverting money away from military spending for the border wall, or in particular, diverting money away from things that could be used to address very sort of, you know, pertinent and timely problems because of the border wall. I think those are politically more risky for the president.
It is very motivating, and I think we sometimes overlook this about the Trump base, okay? When we say winter is coming and the wall in Game of Thrones, the idea is that impact of saying winter is coming is very motivational, okay? The Trump base is not so concerned about an actual necessarily physical wall. And I know that infuriates a lot of people, but they are more interested in the spirit of saying we need to prepare for this onslaught of, you know, undocumented immigration, and we need to prepare for all these people invading our country.
And talk about fake news.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's fake news. It shifts the ability to have legislative focus in a way that we haven't had in a while.
We got to get to a break. But, Greg, one of the things that I think about when I think of any cuts in military spending in Georgia is I think back to a Senator Sam Nunn, or even further back to a Senator Richard Russell. Now, they happened to be Democrats, but it really didn't matter. Mm-hmm. When it came down to military spending in the state of Georgia, they were fierce in protecting against any federal attempt to take money away from the state. And I wonder if we are living in an environment that's similar to that today. David Perdue joined at the hip to President Trump. Johnny Isaacson's become a free agent. He will certainly be able to step up. But the environment's changed in a way, or am I wrong?
Well, you better believe these projects are coveted by the local congressman. I mean, Representative Rick Allen in Augusta area is probably fiercely fighting behind the scenes. I don't know how much he'll say publicly over the next few days or weeks if that nearly $100 million project for cyber tech in Augusta is imperiled. But they're trying to work behind the scenes. At the same time, though, they've got very limited options because this is a Trump initiative. And if they try to backfill it in the budget process, maybe through the U.S. Senate, then House Democrats are going to block it. They're going to say, hey, you know, this is your doing.
Yeah.
Good luck.
All right.
Perdue's done a lot
quick.
Of preemptive work. In May, you know, he actually went on television speaking much about the president's prioritizing Georgia's military infrastructure. So Perdue's on top of this, I think.
Okay. That's good to keep in the conversation, to balance the conversation, Leo. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the outcome of a special election that took place yesterday, what it tells us about where we're headed in the Georgia House in the year ahead.
As Hurricane Dorian gets closer, GPB has you covered with the latest information from the Georgia Emergency Management Agency. Listen at 4 minutes past each hour, and we'll give you updates on evacuations, shelters, and other state announcements. You can also go to our website, gpbnews.org, for the latest news on the hurricane, plus listen live. You can also follow us on our GPB apps or ask your smart speaker to play GPB.
20 years ago, U.S. voting went electronic without a real understanding of the security risks.
Even if you ask us back then, what exactly should we do to build secure voting machines, we wouldn't have really been able to tell you precisely what you needed to do.
I'm Ari Shapiro. A look at security improvements and the vulnerabilities that remain ahead of the next election this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB, gpbnews.org, and the GPB apps.
Greg Bluestein, one of the most invisible special elections that we've ever seen in Georgia, at least in modern, in the last couple of years, is the special election in House District 71 to replace David Stover, who has been representing a representative out of Noonan. That's Coweta, Fayette counties. There were four candidates, three Republicans, one Democrat. The Democrats thought, maybe this is a Republican district. Mm-hmm. But Democrats thought, well, if Republicans split their votes, we could end up with a Democrat in a runoff. That didn't happen. We do have two Republicans competing now in a runoff, Philip Singleton and Lynn Westmoreland's daughter, Marcy Westmoreland Sackerson. And here's why that's interesting, I think, for a couple reasons. One, the turnout was abysmal. Apparently, Democrats did not show up to vote. And more, it is possible that Philip Singleton is kind of quietly running a campaign in which he's whispering that he would vote against David Ralston if the Republicans maintained control of the House, whereas Sackerson has had the support of Ralston from the start.
Yeah, there's two things here. I mean, it's really hard to read tea leaves in these super low turnout elections. Only a few thousand people voted. There's not a lot of attention, especially in a very crowded Metro Atlanta media market for this race. But there was scant evidence of the people who did turn out of any sort of sign of a Democratic energy around this race. Again, really early. Tea leaves and all, but still, Democrats took solace that she won. The Democrat Jill Prouty won about 50%, more than 50% of the vote in Fayette County. Well, that's just two small precincts that accounted for very little of the overall district. Second thing is, we could have a proxy battle in the runoff between those two Republicans over Speaker Ralston. That's hard too, because Philip Singleton hasn't explicitly opposed Speaker Ralston and said he'd vote against, but he sure is currying support from people who do oppose.
Yeah, Stacey Eric Erickson over at AM 750, the conservative analyst commentator, has been backing Singleton. We know Erickson wants Ralston out of the Speaker's office. So Greg is right. There's a lot of intrigue here. There's smoke, but no fire at this point.
Yeah, and I would say where there's smoke. And that's about it. I mean, I think just because Erickson has called for Ralston to be out and he supports Singleton can't make all of his supporters' enemies his enemies. And I don't really see any overt sign that that's happening. I certainly don't see any sign that the voters know that that's something at play and that that's why they may be voting for Singleton. I don't see it as a proxy for Ralston. And then I would say this too, Ralston's future doesn't hinge on this guy, Singleton. Yeah. So far, there's been such a few number of legislators that have been willing to stand up to Ralston, and I don't see Singleton being sort of the rallying cry that changes that. I will say this about the Democratic turnout. I wouldn't, if I was a Republican, I wouldn't get comfortable that this is any sign of how Democrats will be motivated, because the truth of the matter is it takes money to motivate voters, and there wasn't a significant investment in this race to have seen a increase in Democratic turnout, and that's going to be the complete opposite case when it comes to next November.
It was a long shot for Democrats to begin with.
Yeah.
Yes.
Andra, it is interesting, though. I mean, I think Stacey Evans is right. In some ways, this is kind of a media creation. We're talking about it in terms of Ralston. The AJC has run a couple stories that include a question about whether this is a Ralston battle in some ways. And so maybe this is just us looking for a story here. Nevertheless, do you believe that it is conceivable that after the next round of elections that David Ralston's future as Speaker might be in, you know, at least a little more fragile than it has been?
Well, I mean, I think by his behavior, he has opened himself up to a vulnerability that's not going to go away. So there's always going to be somebody who's going to try to seek to capitalize on it. Whether or not they're even close to being successful is a different story.
Right.
But this is now a part of the narrative. And so for people for whom, you know, he's made enemies within his own party, this is going to be an issue. So I think the question becomes how Speaker Ralston and his allies seek to leverage this. And in particular, in districts like this, do you then mobilize Democrats? Kind of to take the Thad Cochran approach. So in his, you know, last big 2014 Senate race, where he talked about, where he actually openly campaigned to Democrats to remind them that, hey, you might not like me too much, but you like me more than you like the other guy. And so, like, strategically, that might make sense to do in this case if, in fact, you are really worried about this becoming a proxy fight.
Greg, you're nodding.
Yeah, and it's also a show-no-weakness strategy for Ralston. If someone who he doesn't explicitly support because he's him and his allies are funding Sackerson's campaign wins, it could be seen as a sign of weakness, even though the outcome will not determine his future. He also does not want to show any weakness. Now, he's lost primary fights, surrogate battles before, especially
exactly.
in North Georgia, but that doesn't mean he wants to lose anymore.
Leo?
Yeah, I don't see the direct connection to Speaker Ralston's strength in that race. I think this
why is Erickson after
it's good for
Ralston.
Radio ratings.
Is that what it is?
His audience is, you know, they are like dogs on the Ralston story. And so it's great for radio.
Because Ralston's not conservative enough for Eric
That's
Erickson's
correct.
Audience. Eric, you know, Ralston right. has fought against some of their most sacrosanct pieces of legislation, like religious liberty.
And he's not as oppositional. I mean, he just doesn't oppose Democrat leaders just because they're Democrats. I mean, he and a lot of this Republican verve right now is very much be oppositional regardless.
Yeah, I think you could say, Greg, that with the exception of 481, and that's a big, big exception, so it says a lot, Ralston in some ways has been a cooling saucer in terms of conservative ideology.
And look, even with the so-called heartbeat bill, the anti-abortion bill, Ralston was, although he ended up being firmly in support of it, first there was a watered-down variation of it, the trigger bill that was going to really effectively do nothing, that was being pushed by House leadership at first. So
okay. Stacey Evans, yesterday, Carissa Tomlinson's campaign announced that they had the endorsement of Andrew Young and his wife Carolyn. What does that mean for the race for Senate?
It's a big deal. I mean, Ambassador Andrew Young is a coveted endorsement in any Democratic primary. So kudos to Teresa for landing it. And certainly other folks in the race will try to downplay it, but they would all rather have it than not have it. And now she has it. It was very interesting to me that Ambassador Young announced an endorsement when he did, because I don't think that race is set yet. I still think that there are at least one or two other people to get in. And so it was interesting that perhaps it could just be coincidence, but it seemed like to me maybe he was trying to get out in front of something that may be coming.
So on that very point, Andra, two questions for you, I think, really. Number one, do endorsements matter today the way they may have 10, 15 years ago? Does Andrew Young's endorsement matter? And second, is this, in fact, yesterday when we talked about this on the show, the panel suggested this was a way to seal off any more entrance into the Democratic primary. Take any of those you want.
So, I mean, I think the part that's tough about this is that they're two races. And so people have options. So, okay, then. So Andrew Young has made the endorsement in the Democratic primary for the matchup against David Perdue. What about this new matchup now that we have, now that Senator Isaacson has announced his retirement? And so I think that is tough. And I think because the race is kind of up in the air and because both fields haven't completely been settled yet, that's what makes this a lot more complicated. You know, there's still the possibility for one of these candidates or more of them to jump ship on the Perdue race and decide that they'd rather go for the Isaacson seat. So I think that there's a lot out there. What I think it is signaling is that Carissa Tomlinson is here to play. And so she might be trying to clear the field in that particular race and is telling people to go fight in the jungle primary. I don't expect that her opponents are going to pay any attention to that, and they're going to do whatever it was that they had planned on doing before. And while I think Ambassador Young's endorsement certainly carries weight, it certainly sends a signal about establishment support that could help her while we wait to see what those third quarter numbers look like. You know, I think that there's still a lot that, you know, any of these candidates is going to have to do in order to secure the nomination.
Go ahead, Leo.
No, I think this is really interesting because I recall a conversation with you perhaps in Cleveland where we were talking about intergenerational impact.
This was at the Republican National Convention?
We spent a lot of time together. and that we talked about intergenerational differences in the civil rights impact and influence. And I'm starting to wonder, I mean, with the young man from Clarkston, just opposed as a Democrat, right? He's more of that spirit of the young black activist kind of movement spirit. And here,
even though he's a white man, just make sure so, for our viewers, you know, listeners just, who don't know, he's white.
He is white, and he is quite progressive, for pretty far left, in my opinion. So, are we starting to see people like Andrew Young start to say, "Okay, I'm a traditional kind of blue dog Democrat, and I'm transcending the whole racial solidarity kind of, you know, do what the movement is doing kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew Young's been there for decades. I mean, he's an establishment candidate, right? And so he's sending an establishment signal about sort of who he thinks is more electable, who's more pragmatic in this type of situation. So I think, you know, before Senator Isaacson announced his retirement, that Democratic race was going to be a fight for somebody who was probably going to be more acceptable to the establishment versus the young progressive type of candidate. So that was already there. You know, it gets complicated by Sarah Riggs-Amico a little bit, but I don't think it's terribly surprising at all that Andrew Young would endorse the establishment candidate.
The timing of all this was
very early.
Very early, because as Stacey said, the field is not set yet. We're expecting multiple more candidates to get in the race. And the big question has long been, will there be any African-American candidates in this contest? Well, because right now you've got three, maybe soon four, white candidates in this race.
Who's the fourth who's going to jump into what we're now calling Senate race?
Race
against David
John Ossoff
Purdue.
Is very well known to have been looking at this race for a long time. He's had town hall meetings up in North Georgia, far outside the 6th District. He was the unsuccessful 6th
District. But are you telling
candidate.
Us he's ready to do it? You said soon we may have a fourth.
I expect him. I expect him to get in the race. He's widely expected to get in the race. I think that's safe to say. But the thing that happened with the Isaacson resignation, his announcement to retire at the end of the year, is it also got candidates not only looking at that race, but candidates to rethink the Purdue race, who might have said, no way, I'm not interested in the Purdue race, to rethink that one, because now there'll be a lot more money and attention, even though it's a completely different contest with a primary, where the special election for Isaacson is a general election contest. They're going to be re-looking at the Purdue race, and you might see candidates that 2 weeks ago said no way, who are rethinking it, and you could have some bigger names too getting in that race.
Stacey, go ahead.
I think one of those names is Lucy McBath. I think she's looking seriously at getting in a Senate race, and it could be either one, and it'll be really interesting to see what she decides. And obviously, for her, gun safety is a big issue, and I think the fact that Mitch McConnell is sitting on a resolution for background checks that she sponsored is having her think very seriously. You couple that with the Isaacson retirement, and it starts to look very possible that she jumps in one of those races.
Stacey, Andre made the point that it is still conceivable that one of the three who is declared for David Perdue's Senate seat, one of the three Democrats, you know, could switch to Senate race number two. But interestingly enough, all three of them, in the aftermath of Isaacson's announcement, have said no.
Pretty quickly.
Immediately. I mean, Sarah Amico was on our show the day after Johnny made his announcement and said, I'm staying in the David Perdue race. Teresa Tomlinson immediately sent out a note after Johnny's message. So did Ted Terry. You've run a statewide race. Is it, to some extent, have you already, when you declare you're running against David Perdue, have you already essentially told us your reason for being in the race? Have you gone to donors and said, I'm out to beat David Perdue, and is it hard to back away from that then?
Well, I think no. I think they could back away from it if they choose to, and we may very well see one or more of them do just that. But I think it's not surprising that right after the announcement, they all wanted to show strength. And this is the race I've chosen. I'm choosing to go against Purdue. And if they don't switch to the other race, you wouldn't want there to be any soundbite where it looks like you're afraid of David Perdue and that you were thinking that maybe you might need to move over and run for the open seat because it would be easier. They wouldn't want to create that soundbite.
Andra?
I mean, I take that, and I think that that's actually pretty sound reasoning. You don't want to look like you're not just don't you want to look weak, you also don't want to look like you're kind of flip-flopping on issues. And I think the other reason why you might want to stay in the traditional primary versus going to the jungle primary, because I don't actually necessarily think that it is easier to win the jungle primary. You don't have to go up against the incumbent who's had their seat for an entire term of office. But I think what they're thinking is in the ideological fight within the Democratic Party, particularly Terry and Tomlinson, and actually Amico too, they actually represent very sort of different strains of Democratic Party politics, and they're trying to figure out which one of them is dominant in the state. And so they're all convinced that they might actually be the one to put the coalition
before
together.
We take our break, Greg Bluestein, you broke a little bit of news this afternoon on the Insider blog. DNC officials are going to be in town next week to meet with Nkemah Williams, the chair of the state party, and others here to start helping figure figure out who's running for what and where they're headed.
Yeah, I think the party's worst nightmare is kind of what happened to Republicans in the 2017 special election for the 6th District, where there were 18 candidates overall and 6 or 7 really credible Republicans who all, you know, bashed each other and let John Ossoff come within about 2 points of winning that seat outright. Because they were so distracted and focused on attacking each other. So I don't know that Democrats will try to vocally clear the field, but they do want to make sure that everyone understands the stakes, and I think everyone does, but really make clear to every potential Senate Democratic candidate, because there's more than a dozen, what it will take to run this type of campaign that could cost $100 million plus.
All right.
And I think that Kemp's biggest concern about his appointment on the Republican side is who will have the most money to run the campaign.
All right. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about presidential politics. This is Political Rewind.
Downton Abbey is coming to the big screen. Right now, GPB invites you to be among the first to see this new feature film. Join us on Sunday, September 15th in Atlanta for an advanced screening and VIP reception. Tickets are limited, so make sure we hear from you now. Go to gpb.org/Downton tickets to find out more and reserve your seat. That's gpb.org/Downton tickets.
On the next Fresh Air, the alarming growth of overdose deaths from the synthetic opioid fentanyl. We talk with journalist Ben Westhoff, author of Fentanyl, Inc., about the manufacture, sale, and use of fentanyl, which is being added to heroin and other drugs. He spoke to dealers operating on the dark web and visited companies in China that make fentanyl and its components. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Andrew Gillespie, you follow national politics very carefully, very closely. So let's talk about this emerging conventional wisdom among some analysts who are saying, gee, we've still got a long way to go, but the reality is there are now only 3 realistic candidates for the Democratic nomination: Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden. Do you go along with that thinking?
Well, I'm cautious about saying that. I think that there is some truth to this. So in this field of however many it is right now, 21, 20, however many we're at right now, I start to lose count. Right. I think if you didn't make the stage for next week's debate, yeah, you're probably not going to be the nominee.
Yeah.
And those people, you know, I hate to say this, should quit. Right. Because it's you're wasting everybody's time by being a part of the race. You might be bringing up really important ideas, but there are the other things that you could be doing. Some of them in particular could be running for Senate seats. You know, I think for the 10 who did make the cut, yeah, I mean, if you're in the bottom half, the chances are harder, but it's going to be really hard still to convince them of that before the first primary. So barring them running out of money before the end of the year, certain people are putting their, you know, kind of staking their claim on seeing how well they're doing in Iowa and New Hampshire. So they're looking at, you know, what they're doing on the doors in these states. They're looking at what their statewide operations are going to be. And so as a result of that, they think that they might have a chance, even if it's still a bit of a pipe dream. Part of the reason why people are saying that it really is a race of 3 is that the polls have been pretty consistent about who the top 3 are. And so this is very similar. They're thinking back to people kind of crossing their fingers and hoping that Donald Trump wouldn't get the nomination in 2016. You know, you can count the number of weeks on your hands after he announced his candidacy that he wasn't the top vote getter in the polls. And so having seen this consistent behavior, people are saying, yeah, we probably do know who the top 3 are. I think the big wild card in this is whether or not Joe Biden has the potential to implode. And that's why a lot of people are staying in the race, because they think that they might actually be able to sort of benefit from an implosion on his part.
Stacey, there are going to be Democrats out there who, as the momentum moves more and more toward these 3 candidates, as the rules for debates continue to favor a smaller number of candidates, who are going to say the Democrats are making the same mistake they made in 2016, which is they sealed off the race for Hillary Clinton. There weren't as many Democrats, but nevertheless, they had picked one favorite. Mm-hmm. I think there are Democrats out there going to say, we're losing the opportunity to hear voices of our party that matter if we start narrowing the field that dramatically.
Well, folks are going to say that, but folks are wrong. Let me just say that. I mean, you've got 10 people on the debate stage still. We're not talking about three. We're not talking about two. Right. We're talking about 10.
Right.
And some of the most progressive voices are on that stage. It's really the more conservative, moderate voices like Bullock and others that are out. So people are going to say that. Twitter is going to say that. But they're wrong.
All right, Greg, I want to throw something in here and have you comment on this. 538 has a terrific article up on their website right now that talks about the fact that their crunching of numbers shows that it is the most liberal voters who are most engaged right now in Democratic Party politics. So, for instance, when they asked the question of who's paying a lot of attention to the presidential campaign, 69% of the people who say they are, as of August 21st to the 26th, are very liberal. 45% are somewhat liberal. 47% are moderate or conservative. And guess what? It's those very liberal people who are paying attention who all like Elizabeth Warren and who are energized, 538 would argue, to go to the polls and vote.
And it's helping to shape the policies up and down the Democratic presidential field. Right, I mean, it's the reason why we're seeing positions on guns and abortion and income inequality and climate change and things that we that would have been inconceivable, you know, even 4 years ago. So I think too, it's trickling down to Georgia politics too, and you're seeing in the Senate race candidates like Ted Terry, you mentioned him earlier, who have very progressive stances in his town of Clarkston, using those to try to push them statewide.
Andre, do you buy this, that 538 number crunching?
I do. And I actually thought the argument was a little basic because it's median voter theory. And so we think about median voter theory in terms of a general election, that the candidate who is going to appeal to the voter who's ideologically in the center, that's the 50% plus one voter, is the one who wins the election. But we forget that the first part of median voter theory talks about sort of what this looks like in primaries. And when you know you have a truncated electorate that's ideologically truncated, as primaries are, that means that the median voter in a primary is likely going to be more ideologically extreme than a voter is going to be in a general election. So it's not surprising that the Democratic base is more liberal than what the overall sort of, you know, average Democratic voter
is. So that supports, and we're running out of time, but that does support a lot of the thinking that while Joe Biden shows up at the top of all of the horse race polls, when you start digging down into the crosstabs, deeper into the data sets, you find that Biden is not as strong as people might think he is based on the horse race.
Right. And so what that means for, you know, the Biden candidate or any for Sanders or anybody else for that matter, is you got to figure out a way to electrify your base of supporters and make sure that that group actually shows up to vote.
Stacey Evans, Democrat Stacey Evans, have you picked your candidate yet? We ask this question of everybody. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, who's been involved in politics actively. So I'm not picking on you.
I pick whoever gets nominated. That's my candidate. I have my favorite right now, Joe Biden. I've always been a big fan of his. And I found this article really interesting because I think it's not necessarily true that the most plugged in voter is the most likely voter.
Well, that
most likely voters follow
here.
Joe Biden. Those are the reliable, the older voters. They vote every time. They're going to vote. Young people get really excited sometimes about waving signs, but they don't necessarily make it to the polls.
Leo, one very quick comment from you on this. Are you still exiled from the Republican Party for your rejection of President Trump?
I just posted on my Instagram, Leo Smith Politics, a recic Republican exit thing. I haven't exited. I'm still here.
All right. Leo Smith, Andre Gillespie, Stacey Evans, Greg Bluestein, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Bill Nigut. We're off tomorrow, but we'll see you again at 2 o'clock on Friday for another Political Rewind.